Hello, friends. Welcome back to the What If Project podcast. My name is Glenn, and this is episode 293 of the show. What is this show that we're doing? There's been an uptick of downloads recently. I think some new visitors dropping by the show. So welcome to you. What do we do here? This is how I start out every episode. I just start talking. I turn on the microphone. I start talking. There are no ads. There's no fancy intro. It's just me talking to you, a little bit of music, and then whatever conversation we have on deck, which we'll talk about in a moment. But what is this show? I've had people ask me that over the last couple of months who are new to the project. What is the What If Project? Well, very simply, we wonder, what if there are ways of thinking about God and faith and spirituality and the Bible and all the different things that are like way different than what our tradition has handed us? So I come from a fundamentalist evangelical tradition. It's our way or the highway. Believe A, B, and C, or go to hell. It's very, very simple, very straightforward, black and white, and that's it. And I was in that place for a long time. Then I started to ask some questions, and I started to learn some things. And now I'm learning that the road of Christianity is actually quite wide and diverse, not as narrow and straightforward as I was told that it was. And so again, we wonder, what if there's ways of understanding this stuff that's different than what we've been told? We also have, as part of the project, the What If Project Media help. I do a lot of social media for people. Alexander John Shia, Choir Publishing, Bart Ehrman, some other people as well. And I love to help people spotlight their work in the virtual world by making graphics and different things like that. So anyway, What If Project Media help is, what if there's ways to get help with your content creation? Maybe you don't like to make things. You don't like to, you know, create stuff to market your work, whatever. What if there's ways to get help with all of that? That's not going to break the bank, because I try to keep my prices fair, and I've actually worked with people on the price who maybe couldn't even afford what I offered, and just help them get something out there to make their work, to make them feel like their work is being spotlighted in a way that brings them some joy. And so there's that. And then there's the What If Project Art Studio, which is, you know, what if there's, what if it's possible to create stuff, whether it's art, it's music, it's writing, whatever, just for the purpose of it bringing you joy? What if it's possible to create stuff apart from worrying about getting likes and shares and getting the algorithm to see you and put you out there and all this different stuff? What if it's possible just to create stuff without caring about any of that? I've been doing a lot of art recently, a lot of painting. I've been putting some of my things up there. Some people have said they'd like to buy stuff, so I said, just name your price. As long as it covers shipping, I don't care. I'll send it to you. And that's the What If Project Art Studio. So a place for you to get inspired by the joy that my stuff brings me. Hopefully you can tap into your own joy, create your own stuff, and we can make the world a more joyful place together. So the What If Project has many different branches. But that's essentially what it is we wonder, what if there's ways of thinking about all of this stuff that's different than what our tradition has handed us? So today we're talking to Carl McColeman. He wrote a book called The New Big Book of Christian Mysticism, An Essential Guide to Contemplative Spirituality. Mysticism shares the same root as the word mystery, right? And I don't know about you, but me growing up, again, very fundamentalist, it was all about, you know, there was no mystery. We had God all figured out. We had our T's crossed, our I's dotted, the list of beliefs you have to believe, the systematic theology books, all the different things. Everything was set in stone. You just got to sign your name and believe, and you are bound for heaven. Mysticism is like the opposite of that in many ways. It's about embracing mystery, right? It's really about wondering, what if there's ways of thinking about God that are different than all these different ways. It's about becoming comfortable with the mystery, becoming comfortable with not knowing, embracing a season in your life of unknowing some of the things that you think you used to know so well. And this is a new world for me in the last, you know, few years. I've been exploring it. But Carl's book is super, super helpful. A big historical section of kind of the history of mysticism in the Christian faith and just mysticism overall, because there's even mystics out there who are not religious in any way at all, but they still have a mystical way of thinking. So he talks about all of that, talks about some different exercises and practices to for a contemplative spirituality within Christianity. Really, really good stuff. We have a fun conversation here. Carl is somebody who I've come across his work a few times, and I decided to reach out to him and see if I can get him on the show. Obviously, he came on, and we have some other things that we'll probably do down the road as well. I think he has another book coming out next year or the year after, something like that. So anyway, this is episode 293. All the links to Carl's stuff is in the show notes. Links to my books, Rethinking Everything, Emerging from the Rubble. Patreon, if you'd like to support the show financially, you can do it there. All the links are in the show notes. But for now, episode 293 with Carl McCullman, talking to us about Christian mysticism and contemplative spirituality. Enjoy. All right, hey everybody, welcome back to the podcast. Today we're joined by a brand new guest. His name is Carl McCullman. He wrote an amazing book called The New Big Book of Christian Mysticism. It is jam-packed with all sorts of mystical goodness. And so, Carl, welcome to the podcast. I've been looking forward to our conversation.
Oh, it's a delight to be here, Glenn. Thanks.
Thank you. So before we get into your book, can you maybe tell us a little bit about yourself, especially for people who are maybe new to you and your work? Who are you? What do you do? Tell us what we need to know.
Well, hi, I'm Carl. I am somebody who comes out of, middle class, white, post World War II. I'm a young boomer. You know, I was born in 1960. Kind of world. I grew up in mainline Protestant. My mom and dad were Lutheran. Out of that world, I got involved in the kind of the charismatic renewal in the 70s, had a very kind of deep sense of spiritual awakening. Actually, before I fell in with the charismatics, it was like that was what impelled me into the charismatic world. Mm-hmm. And in the charismatic world, I just began to, you know, bump into some disconnects between my kind of embodied experience of the sacred and the narrative that community had. And so by the time I was in college, I transferred my membership to the Church of Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll. and so my college period was kind of a time of hedonism, exploration. You know, I was reading people like Alan Watts. If you know Alan Watts, from 50 years ago, but he was an Anglican priest who then became a Buddhist, you know, that kind of thing. Then, but also, I'm leaving out one important bit. A friend of mine after that, well, okay, let's just say, after I graduated from high school, I had a dream about the world coming to an end. Mm. And so a friend of mine who I knew through the Lutheran Church actually gave me a copy of a book called Mysticism by Evelyn Underhill, who is a British writer on mysticism. And that book just was it opened up a whole new world for me. So by the time I got to graduate school, I thought, you know, faith still meant something to me. But I wanted a more kind of open faith. So I found my way into the Episcopal Church. Mm. And I was an Episcopalian for many years. And while I was an Episcopalian, I began to explore contemplative prayer, what we now call centering prayer. Began meeting with a spiritual director, that kind of thing. There's lots more twists and turns, but let's just say as of today, I am what has been called a dual practitioner. So I'm still a Christian. I'm still, very much active in the Christian world. But I also identify as Buddhist. So I'm kind of a Christian Buddhist. The Thomas Merton, the great Trappist monk, said right before he died, he said, "I see no contradiction between Buddhism and Christianity." And I think on the level of practice, I 100% agree with him. On the level of maybe doctrine, you can bump into things. But on the level of doctrine, Catholics and evangelicals don't get along, so
Evangelicals say Catholics are not Christians.
and so and most Catholics, most conservative Catholics would return the favor, but
Right. Feel the same way.
So my spirituality today, still very much just hopelessly in love with Jesus, so deeply embedded within the Christian tradition. But I like to say I'm an interfaith friendly Christian. So
Yeah. I love
that's
that. And it's funny because like I told you before we hit record, I grew up in the evangelical world where it's our way or the highway. And I was given this very narrow understanding of God, of faith, of the church, of theology, of all these different things. And so I literally went through Bible college, many years of seminary, pastoring a church with this mindset that this is the way that you have to believe. But internally, I always struggled because I always felt like I had issues with different doctrines like hell or, predestination was like a big word in my world or, like the omnipotence of God and all these different kind of things. Like, but I stuffed all those questions down because I was told, well, you just got to believe that this is the way that it is. But then I came across some different books. A big one for me was Love Wins by Rob Bell, where he positioned hell in a much different way. And I remember I was reading this book. I got the book and I read it until like 2 o'clock in the morning because I was fascinated. And I was like, I can't believe that there's another way to look at these things and still identify as a Christian. And that just totally blew my mind. And that led me down this rabbit hole of exploring all these different kinds of doctrines and realizing that, the history of Christianity is very wide, or I was told it was very narrow. And there's been many ways that people have always believed about these different kind of things. And that gave me a huge level of freedom because, like you just said, you still identify as a Christian. But back in my day, when I 15 years ago, I would have said, Carl, you're not a Christian.
Well, I'm sure there are plenty of people, nowadays who are alarmed that I am a practicing Buddhist and who are alarmed that I'm still a practicing Christian. So
Right. How do those two things work? Right.
the Venn diagram, it seems like it's a real small slice in the middle, but I'm not the only one in there. There's some interesting people hanging out, so.
Absolutely. All right. So your book, the first question I was going to ask you before I read the book was I was going to ask you if you could identify or tell us, like, define what mysticism is, because I feel like everybody I talk to, everybody explains it like in a different way. And so I was looking for like one concise definition, but then I read the first chapter of your book and realized that even you, who wrote the big book of mysticism, kind of struggled to pin down, a single concise definition. So I guess if I had to morph my question to something else, it would be, can you talk to us a little bit about what this idea of mysticism has come to mean for you in your daily life and your spiritual practice, and maybe even like what it used to mean, what it means now, has it evolved, has it changed, all those different kinds of things.
Well, and I've been, and you mentioned this is the new edition of this book. This book first came out in 2010, what we now affectionately could call the old big book of Christian mysticism. So I've been doing interviews like this for over a decade now, and I keep getting asking the question, and there's no, I don't have a soundbite. There's no little formula that I just trot out and say, this is what mysticism is. And part of it is because, well, there are a number of ways to approach it. Well, let's begin just with the etymology of the word itself. Mysticism is related to mystery. That's easy for people to kind of grasp, but it's also related to silence. And the way to explain that is think of, on your phone or your TV remote, the mute button. Or even on Zoom, we have a mute button. In
I
fact,
can mute you right now if I want
my
to.
wife gave me this cool little doodad for, because I'm on Zoom all the time. She gave me this cool little doodad that plugs right into my computer, sits on my desk. It's like a keyboard with two buttons, and one is video on and off, and the other one's mute.
Oh, very nice.
So it's you know how you're fumbling to unmute yourself, and
All the
everybody's saying we
time.
can't hear you, we can't hear you. Well,
Right.
I've got that button. But so the mute button. We all know what the mute button is. The word mute comes from the same Greek word that the word mysticism comes from.
Interesting.
Yeah. So mysticism, you could also call it mutism. So mysticism is the spirituality, and it's universal. Obviously, there's a Christian mysticism, which is what I've written about, but there's a mystical element in every wisdom tradition. The mystical element of spirituality is that dimension of spirituality that faces life, God, the universe, spirit, et cetera, with a humble recognition that it ultimately cannot be put into words. And that therefore, silence is an appropriate response. Let me just say this, a freely embraced silence, because silence can get toxic too. So we can talk about that. But a freely embraced silence is an appropriate response to the mystery. And when we do try to talk about the mystery, we always end up betraying it in some way, shape, or form. One of my favorite little taglines is whatever reveals God also conceals God. And so that is, if you want a mystical soundbite, that's as good as it gets.
That's
Whatever,
good.
yeah, whatever reveals God also conceals God. And so, you know, for a lot of Christians, they'd be like, but wait a minute, the Bible reveals God. And I'd say, yes, the Bible reveals God, and the Bible also conceals God. That the Bible has been used, you know, in a weaponized way. It's been used as weapon. It's been a weapon against queer people, against women, against people who don't necessarily choose to follow Jesus, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so as soon as you weaponize the Bible, you've concealed God. So that's just across the board. So one of the things about mystical spirituality or mystical theology, if you will, is it always brings us to this place of profound humility. And this place of, you know, when I talk about God, I'm talking about mystery. When I talk about my soul, I'm talking about mystery. You know, I'm talking about topics that, you know, near and dear to the heart of many Christians, salvation, evangelization, the sacraments, if you're a Catholic, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We're always talking about something that we can only ultimately encounter through the veil of mystery. And that doesn't mean there's no point in talking about these things. I think that's where some people go. In fact, that's a road to agnosticism or even to atheism. Because it's human nature to talk. What are you and I doing right now? It is human nature to share ourselves. And like it or not, language is the tool we have, the gloriously messy and imperfect tool we have to communicate. And so mysticism also implies this dialectic between silence and speech, or silence and language, or silence and word. And I think when you begin to think about that, then you read the first chapter of St. John, and it just comes open in a whole new way. Yes, Jesus is the word, but in order to hear a word, that word must be spoken in silence. You know, if you and I are standing at a heavy metal concert, you know, and we're right in front of the speakers, and it's going full throttle. You know, and we try to talk, we cannot talk. You know, we're maybe if we shout at each other, but we're probably going to be sitting there with, you know, or standing in front of a jet engine. You're going to be sitting there writing something down or using sign language or whatever. You know, the word must have silence in order to be heard, in order to be received. So that's just a few ways we can enter into what mysticism is. And the reality is that mysticism takes many shapes and forms. There are different strands, just within Christianity, different strands of kind of mystical experience or mystical practice or thought. So as soon as you say one thing about mysticism, you know, it's like whack-a-mole. Up comes somebody else who says, well, actually, I see it this way, you know.
Yeah, the whole idea of mystery has been a really it's been a journey for me, because coming out of that world I came from, I always had an answer for everything, because that's what the Bible said. The Bible says, whatever book it says, to always be prepared with an answer for the
Chapter and verse.
questions. And so we always have that. So I always prided myself on, knowing my systematic theology book, the Wayne Grudem textbook that we had in seminary. And Josh McDowell's The Evidence That Demands a Verdict, and always having really systematized God and theology. And then when I started to like deconstruct and started to ask a lot of questions, I hung on to that because I felt like I still needed to have the answers if I was going to be a faithful Christian. And so I can remember having like all these different questions about, well, if I don't believe this about the cross anymore, then what do I do with this verse? And what do I do with that verse? And going after all of these questions. But then eventually I came to this place where I'm like, I forget who said it to me. I think it was somebody on the podcast, maybe Brian McLaren said to me that you're going to come to a place one day in your faith where you're just okay with not knowing the answer. And that's going to become a very scary place at first, but then you're going to find it a very resting place and a very freeing place. And that's where I'm at now. Like, I used to engage in these conversations with people, go back and forth about, what you believe and different things like that. And those are interesting. But now I land in this point where I don't know. I don't know the answer. I like to wonder. I like to imagine. I like to embrace the mystery of it all. But I think there's just a lot of different angles to come with these questions from. And that's become the fascinating piece to me, is to see the different perspectives that people have as opposed to landing on the right final answer.
Well, let's go back to Wayne and Josh's excellent adventure. And I mean, yeah, I'm familiar, even though I come out of the Catholic tradition, I'm familiar with both Wayne Grudem and Josh McDowell, and God bless them. But that whole narrative project is dualistic. It's built on this proposition is right and that proposition is wrong.
That's right.
And the only way security can be held is by weaponizing your proposition to clobber all competing propositions. So it is literally built on aggression. And when you see that, it's like one of those, I don't know how old you are, but I'm old enough. I remember the Magic Eye posters back in the
Yeah,
80s.
sure. I'm 42, but yeah, I know what you're
Okay, so
talking about.
you were a kid. I was a young adult, but when those Magic Eye, if for anyone listening who doesn't know, the Magic Eye posters are these computer generated posters. They were a fad in the late 80s, and you look at them and it just looks like an abstract art. But if you relax your eyes, a 3D image pops out at you. And so this is part of what I think the deconstruction project is we relax our grip on our faith. And then things pop out, and they've been there all along, but we never saw them. But once we see them, we can't unsee them.
That's right.
And so, seeing how much aggression is baked into that kind of dualistic, literalist, fundamentalist, whatever label you want to give it, Richard Rohr calls it the reward punishment paradigm, and it's so insidious. I still hear evidences of it in my own language or in my wife's language. She and I were talking yesterday, and she was talking about, something like about waking up. We must wake up. And I'm like, why must we?
It's just a little, right?
And so we dug a little, and she was raised Southern Baptist, and it's just, and then she realized, oh my God, that's that old punishing God model that you must do this or else. And here she is, carrying it still in her, and I've got it in me too. So deconstruction is a long-term process, but it is that process of learning to see things that were always there, but we've just never been trained to see them.
Yeah, I feel like deconstruction is a it's like it's ongoing. There's it's like I think, okay, I've dug through this thing, and then all of a sudden, oh, there's another thing, another mentality that I need to kind of rethink. And I've come to call it the Christian soldier inside. He arises out of the dirt every once in a while and says, no, you have to do it this way, you have to think about it this way, or whatever. 'Cause I can remember back in seminary there was this one class, it's very vivid, where there was a New Testament class. I think it was like background and context of the New Testament. And the professor was talking about a differing viewpoint that like another group has, like this other group. And again, it was very dualistic. And he said, when this other group brings up this argument, here's the verses you use to nail their hide to the wall. That's what he said. And I remember thinking to myself, like, that doesn't feel right. You know what I mean? Like I hadn't really started to deconstruct yet, but I was like, something about that, like weaponizing the Bible in that way to shoot somebody down, to nail them to the wall. Like, didn't they nail Jesus to the cross? Like, why are we talking about nailing people? You know, I mean, using the, it just didn't make sense to me, but like, I remember feeling like that just feels very off to me. But yet that's the soldier that's ingrained. It
Yeah.
feels at times into my DNA that pops up here and there. Like you said with your wife, that sometimes I have to take a step back and go, whoa, like, need to rethink why I just thought that way or said that.
Yeah. And I thank you for sharing that story. That's a wonderful story and a really profound story. And something that I think about a lot, that how violence is really baked into the central mystery of the Christian faith. Our faith is a 2,000-year-old conversation about political trauma encountering a beautiful spiritual teacher. And what I think, and as Rohr says, if you don't transform your pain, you transmit it.
That's right.
And I think that the aggression that we see in so much Christianity towards non-Christians, towards queer people, towards, white people, towards people of color. I mean, it exists on so many levels. It's because we are all carrying this religious trauma in our heart and in our DNA. And if we're not actively working on healing that and transforming it, transfiguring it, we're just going to spray it out there. Like you say, that soldier is going to pull out the gun and start shooting.
That's right.
And so, I mean, I'm also a fan of mimetic theory, and so the whole idea that Jesus represents the final kind of renunciation of the scapegoat model. And yet we see Jesus as a scapegoat. And then what does Christianity do? So, or at least big, huge elements of Christianity, we actively scapegoat others. It's like, it's like the message that Jesus gave us, a message of, we do not do religious violence. We do not scapegoat others. We do not other others. And here we are, 2,000 years later, and we still haven't gotten the memo. Many of us still haven't gotten the memo,
That's right.
so.
Can you talk to us about the some of the differences, like the different types of mysticism, because you alluded to it just a little while ago, and you talk about it in your book that there is both Christian and non-Christian mysticism, but there's also theistic or God-centered mysticism and non-theistic mysticism. So mysticism can orient from various understandings of God, or maybe even no understanding of God at all, which, to be honest with me, confused me a lot because I've only ever heard this word used in the context of some sort of belief in God. So maybe you could talk to
Right.
us a little bit about what these different types of mysticism look like.
And that might also be a generational thing, because again, I came up in the 60s and 70s, and so you heard kind of in the cultural zeitgeist this concept of Eastern mysticism. It was kind of, and the thing is that when I think about, Buddhist or Hindu teachers that were active in America at that time, they probably did not describe themselves as mystics. That was probably put on them, So this is another thing about mysticism, is because the topic itself is so impossible to define, the word gets used by different people in sometimes radically different ways. So I think, like, when just kind of our secular culture talks about Eastern mysticism as kind of a code word for Zen or Taoism or yoga or, Hinduism, Vedanta, it's like you've got all these different spiritualities or wisdom lineages in the East. Okay, Eastern mysticism becomes the umbrella term. It's almost at that point, it's almost just a synonym for spirituality, So you do run into that. If you say Zen is Eastern mysticism, or Buddhism is Eastern mysticism, Buddhism is a non-theistic tradition. It's not atheistic. You know, again, you know, it's funny because I do sit with a sangha, and everybody in the sangha knows that I'm a Christian and that I write books on Christian spirituality. And it's like, generally speaking, the Buddha seems to be much more accepting of my Christianity than many Christians are of my engagement with Buddhism. But if you ask the Buddhists, and I can tell you, some of them would say they believe in God, and some of them would say they don't, and a lot of them would say that's not relevant to what we're doing here. You know, going to sangha is like going to the gym. You know, you can go to the gym whether or not you believe in God. You can become a Buddhist whether or not you believe in God. So then, well, then what do we mean when we talk about Buddhist mysticism? Well, we're still talking about that kind of cultivation of the human heart or the human soul. So in a theistic sense, mysticism is relational. Whatever we mean when we say God, you know, I mean, I love John Lennon's definition. God is a concept by which we measure our pain. You know, there are so many different ways that we talk about God. What is it, Rob Bell, what we talk about when we talk about God? You know, there's so many different ways we even what that term actually means. But I think for most of us, it has some sense of, you know, the love at the heart of the universe, the love that brought all things into being, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a relationality to a theistic mysticism, whether you're talking about, you know, in Judaism, Kabbalah. In the Muslim world, you have the Sufi traditions, those you could call mystical traditions. Certainly within Christianity, you have the contemplative traditions. Again, I swim in Catholic waters, so I'm a little bit more well-versed there, but you have like the Jesuits, you have the Benedictines, the Cistercians, you know, these different, and each one has a slightly different culture, maybe a different approach to meditation or contemplation. But at the end of the day, they're all, you know, talking about Jesus, you know, so there's still that essential unity. And so there's that relational quality. If you get away from theism, you can say, well, the relationality, I don't think it disappears, but I think it looks different. It becomes, what is my relationship with my most authentic self? What is my relationship with the human community? You know, in Buddhism, for example, you have the concept of the bodhisattva, who is the person who actually defers their enlightenment because they want to be of service to others. Now, I don't know about you, but that sounds an awful lot like what Christianity is. You know, you love God and love your neighbors, you know. So that love your neighbors part is pretty bodhisattva-ish, you know. I mean, again, enlightenment is not a category that most Christians, you know, worry about. But this idea that part of being in a relationship with God means being of service to others. You know, so that relationality, I think, is part of mysticism. But then is God a meaningful signifier for the mystery? And if you say yes, you're a theistic mystic. If you say no or not sure, then you're kind of a non-theistic mystic. But you can still enter into that relationship with mystery, that relationship with your own authentic self, that relationship with others, that you want to be shaped by compassion and kindness and mercy and forgiveness and justice and, you know, the values that most Christians that I think are healthy Christians hold really, really important. Those values are exportable. You know, those are meaningful values to the entire human family. So.
I have a friend who identifies as a agnostic, maybe borderline atheist. He kind of falls like on that somewhere on that line, he calls himself, but he knows the Bible very well. He used to be a Christian, but yet he identifies this other way. But yet in my mind, I'm like, you still exercise very many Christian principles in your life. And he seems to be a very mystical thinker in the way that he kind of talks about, you know, the Bible, and even talks about how the Bible portrays God and things like that. And in my mind, I'm like, are you sure you're not a Christian?
Well, you know, and I can tell you, I've run into evangelicals, including a very prominent evangelical who abandoned his faith. And he was speaking, I'm not going to name names here, but he was speaking at the Wild Goose Festival a few years ago. And he was telling his faith journey, his journey out of, you know, being a pretty, you know, anchored, solid evangelical to this place where he really just identified not as an agnostic, but as an atheist. And the whole time I'm listening to him, I'm thinking, if he had a grounding in the mystics, it probably would have been a much gentler journey for him. Because what the mystics do is they take us, and okay, so when we hear the word agnostic, what most of us think an agnostic is somebody who says, well, I'm not sure that there is a God, so I'm gonna, see you around. I'm gonna go to the bar,
Right.
Whereas the mysticism takes us to this place, not of I doubt that God exists, but that I recognize that all of our language, all of our concepts, our syntax, it all fails. And so phenomenologically, that doesn't look that different from agnosticism. But I think it's a different quality of the soul. Because that kind of, and I've called it in my blog, I call this holy agnosticism, because it's you're in this place of unknowing with deep humility, and then a real desire to preserve what is good and sacred about our tradition, about the narrative, the story. I mean, Christianity, and it's funny because in my book I say mysticism is a story, but I also believe Christianity is a story. The Bible is a book of stories. I mean, I know theology can get pretty abstruse, especially nowadays, but historically, the theologians were storytellers. Think about the Desert Mothers and Fathers or the Celtic saints, people like that. The mystics, many of the mystics were storytellers. So, Anthony de Mello, if you've read any of his work, he was a Jesuit that lived in India. It's just stories. So narrative is such an important part of what it means to be a person of faith. So you preserve what is sacred in those narratives, even when you realize, I cannot read these narratives from a posture of certainty that I have the truth, the one and only truth. That when I run into that now, that just feels very brittle and arrogant and maybe even ignorant. It doesn't, that's a position that doesn't seem to take into perspective the full picture. I was thinking today about, I have so many loved ones in my life, both family and friends, who come from very rural places. And most of those people, many of them are people of faith, typically are people who tend to be very resistant or uncomfortable with queer people. And the reality is that most, in my experience, most LGBTQ people, certainly most communities, most healthy communities, tend to be in urban areas. And so I'm like, yeah, maybe they're uncomfortable because they don't know any queer people, or they don't know that they know any queer people. All the queer people they know are very closeted. And so there's like there's a whole segment of life experience that is not part of their story. And again, they react with kind of anxiety or discomfort, which is not an unusual reaction. I'm not trying to defend that. Because I think it leads to harm. Homophobia leads to harm. Transphobia leads to harm. But I'm saying I understand that. I think many people who hold that are people that don't have the same life experience that others do. And so, so this is why, I mean, we want to talk about politics. The biggest problem I think in American politics is that we don't talk to each other. We shout at each other. We debate with each other. We try to nail each other to the wall. But we're not talking and listening.
That's
See,
right.
which goes back to silence, could bring it back to mysticism. The silence is the medium by which we listen. So mysticism is a spirituality of deep listening, listening to your own heart, listening to your soul, listening to the still small voice, which can only come to us through a whisper.
I think listening to others too, right? Because I feel like,
Well, which goes back to what I was just saying about, I mean, like, I still remember the first time I met a Muslim, and she was wearing a hijab, and in my mind, a hijab was just a form of patriarchal oppression that Muslim men used to oppress Muslim women, and she and I had a long conversation about what the hijab meant to her, and I came away, and she said, well, your nuns all wear veils, that doesn't bother you. It's kind of, well, that's different. She's like, no, actually, it's
It's
not. So,
actually
but because by the grace of God, I had the humility to actually listen to another person's story,
not.
it opened my experience and my understanding. So.
Yeah, I've told this on the podcast before, but growing up in the world I grew up in, you know what my beliefs were about gay people and the LGBTQ community. And I never, looking back over my life, I never had like any kind of interaction with a gay person. I was told all about them. I had all the theories about them. I was told the way that they are and why they are the way that they are and what the Bible says about them. But I never once engaged with someone, even through college, seminary, never interacted with a gay person. So I wrote all the papers, and defending my position on the topic, everything like that. But then I got to work at Apple, an Apple retail store. And I worked there for, ended up there for 11 years, which is a whole nother story. But this was the first real place where I met like a lot of people who were gay. And I work in a store that has 150 people in it. Everybody's, we have Muslim people, we have all different types of people from all different types of backgrounds. And this is my first experience like outside of my little bubble, like with this amount of people. And I was trained by somebody in the store who was gay. I became friends with people who were gay. I started to hear their stories. I even heard them pray on occasion, saw them, and I'm thinking, it just blew my mind. And I remember sitting in the lunchroom one day thinking to myself, I've been handed a whole lot of lies. Like, this is, all of a sudden, this doesn't make any sense. Like, the theology I've given is breaking down in the context that I'm living in. And I started to realize that, because I had no proximity to people who are gay, I had no empathy for them because I never once was able to had the opportunity to listen to somebody and to hear their story. But as soon as I had proximity, I had more empathy and I started to hear their stories, and that really softened my heart, made me realize that I need to rethink these verses that I know so well and this stuff I know so well. And I even went as far as to say that if the Bible does say that, then the Bible must be wrong. I remember thinking to myself, that was a big thing in my head, because I was like, I don't know if these two things can coexist in the experience that I'm having. And that was a huge piece of my deconstruction.
It's thank you for sharing that story. And the one comment I would offer back to you is I'm sure you did know gay people, but they were all deeply closeted,
Exactly.
possibly even from themselves, because my sense is that in the world, again, I don't know you except from today,
Sure,
but I'm
sure,
assuming
sure.
the world you grew up in was the kind of world where the only way to be openly gay was to be in some form of kind of penance for that.
Yep.
You're either undergoing conversion therapy or committing yourself to a life of celibacy
Yep.
or something like that. That was the only social space for same-sex attraction
Yep.
in that world. And so then to encounter people who don't play by those rules and yet who still love Jesus, or who still are living lives of profound service and care and compassion, and who are mentally healthy and who have long-standing loving relationships. It's a mind blower, I think, for somebody who grows up with kind of a straight cisgender, very narrow way of seeing the world.
That's right. That's right. So all this talk about mysticism in our Western mindset, it's easy to make every bit of this theoretical, right? Like I said, back in seminary, I had this obsession with systematic theology and systematizing God and my beliefs and things like that. And one of the things I was really interested in when I was in seminary was spiritual formation, and really in particular the spiritual disciplines, where my approach anyways was to kind of master these different disciplines so I could train my body, train my mind to have these different experiences with God. And I think it seems like there's a place for those disciplines and things like that, obviously, in mysticism, but it seems to lean a lot less on theory and more on practice. So I'm wondering if you could maybe talk to our listeners who are raised more in that fundamentalist setting that leaned heavily on dogma, theology, knowledge, mastering principles, things like that. Like, what are some different ways that you found helpful to kind of get out of your head, get out of the books, and into a more like embodied experience with all this stuff we're talking about?
Well, I think first of all, and it's funny because the book that I'm writing right now, it'll come out in 2025, but the book is the working title. It could change, but the working title is "Read the Bible Like a Mystic."
I
And
love it. Very nice.
so this is a subject that's very, very near and dear to my heart. The Bible, I think, is a profoundly mystical book. But back to the magic eye painting, I haven't been taught to see
Yep.
the mystical theology within the Bible.
Yep.
It's learning to pay attention. Okay, one of my favorite verses. Proof texting is such a bad thing, and yet I do it too.
All the
Yeah, we all do. Everybody, we
time.
all know it's wrong, and we
Even
all do
Jesus
it.
did
I know. That's the thing. Okay,
it,
if
right?
Jesus could get it, and Paul, if they could get away with it, why not
That's
me?
right.
But and believe me, the mystics throughout history. Oh yeah, they Saint Benedict, like the best of them. Romans 5:5. Hope does not disappoint us because the love of God has been poured into our hearts through the Holy Spirit who's been given to us. So I wrote a book called Eternal Heart, which actually the title comes from Ecclesiastes 3:11. God has placed eternity in the human heart. And so there's this book is just a reflection on eight different passages in the Bible, which talks about gifts that have been placed in our heart. And so that's the first thing I would say. If you come out of a Bible-based spiritual background, recognize that, yeah, there's actually teachings in the Bible that lead us here. So that's just kind of a prelude. What has been passed down generation after generation after generation, the three words, prayer, meditation, and contemplation. And the first two, of course, are biblical terms. Let the words of my mouth and the meditations of my heart be acceptable to you. Okay, so right away, there you got the silence in the language, the words of my mouth, the meditation of my heart. The heart doesn't have a vocal cord. The meditation of our heart is a silent meditation. So we offer both of those. So contemplation, I think the closest you have in scripture there, but it is there, is this idea of Mary pondering in her heart. Mary ponders Jesus' teachings in her heart. You see that more than once. I think it's always in Luke, but you do see it more than once. And so this idea that that we are invited into prayer, into having this kind of conversational relationship with God, but also into being silent before the mystery. And then being willing to ponder, being willing to wait, being willing to be patient in that whole process. That's kind of a three-legged stool of kind of a mystical practice. If you're familiar with the monastic tradition, the Catholic monastic tradition, I imagine you see it in Orthodox traditions too, but this idea of lectio divina, this idea you read a passage from scripture, and then what do? You do three things with it. You meditate on it, you pray over it, but then you contemplate it in silence. So right away, there's that kind of that key. So it continually amazes me how many Christians are afraid of silence. And oh, and that was the other thing I was going to say. And then we got back to the LGBTQ question. Those that, like I said, you probably knew some closeted LGBTQ, gay, lesbian people. That's an example of toxic silence. Their sexuality has been silenced by a system that had no room for them. So we do have to be careful this. Even silence casts a shadow. Anytime silence is imposed, that's a toxic silence. So the silence of mystical spirituality is the silence we freely enter into. It is the silence in every heart, between every heartbeat, in every mind, between every thought. So we carry this silence within us. So the mystical practice fundamentally is, pray, talk to God, tell Jesus what's going on in your heart. Absolutely. But then learn to pay attention to the silence between the words. And over time, you begin to hunger for that silence. You begin to thirst for that silence. This is back to your exchange with Brian, that you come to that point where you feel safe in the not knowing. That's pretty close. It's in the same neighborhood as feeling safe in the silence.
That's right.
And so coming to recognize and the theology of mystical prayer, and the best contemporary teacher on this, he just died a few years ago, was a Trappist monk named Thomas Keating, but there have been others throughout history. But the general teaching is that as we rest in silence before the mystery, the spirit is at work deep within us at a level below the threshold of our conscious awareness. And so this idea, again, that the spirit that's been poured into our heart, the love of God that's been poured into our heart, that is working, but the heart is below The threshold of the awareness is right at the vocal cord. It's
Mm.
below the threshold of awareness. So
Yeah.
trusting. So another big piece of mystical spirituality is this gesture of trust. Julian of Norwich, great mystic, said, that God wants us to pray and God wants us to trust. God wants us to be generous in both. And so, you could say that that's another way of approaching this, that the prayer obviously is prayer. The trust would be the meditation. And then the generosity would be that contemplative, that stance of waiting and of stillness.
Yeah.
So that's in a nutshell what kind of mystical practice looks like. It's very much an embodied practice. It's learning to get out of your head and into your heart.
Yeah.
So
Thinking back to what you're saying about silence, I thought that was interesting. You brought it up early in our conversation about how silence can be a toxic thing, and it makes sense about this imposed, whenever silence is imposed, that's when it has a tendency to be on the more toxic side of things. And that made me think about an imposed silence in relation to questions, right? Because for me, like growing up again in that world I grew up in, you weren't allowed to have questions. Or if you did, you just had it, you had to have more faith than you had more questions. And if you just had more faith, your questions would be silent. So I can remember having like real questions about things like hell and real questions about things like, evil in the world and things like that. But the answer I was always given was you just have to believe. Like one day when you die and you get to heaven, it's all gonna make sense. Everything's gonna, all the pieces will fit back into place. But for now, like this is your test. You have to endure these questions and believe. Like that's the test of your faith, And so now looking back on it, I realize like what a, especially having a daughter who's now six and she's starting to ask lots of questions, like really how abusive it can be and how toxic it can be to try to silence the questions that somebody has and try to overpower them with what the answer is, and that you just need to believe this answer and that'll squash your question and then you can move on with your life. And really how that imposing that silence on somebody can be a very hurtful and harmful thing for their faith and for their life.
And compare that to the alternative where the question might be a doorway into freedom.
Right.
And that, it's funny, Richard Rohr and Brian McLaren are showing up a lot in this conversation, but I was on a call with Richard Rohr about a year or so ago. No, not Richard, with Brian about a year or so ago. And Brian was telling us the story about being on an airplane and sitting next to a rabbi. And so they got to chatting, and she, told him she was a rabbi, and he told her he was a Christian author, and da 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 da. And they just kind of hit it off, and they're just having this conversation. And so she finally says, "One of the things I've never understood about you Christians is why you think the Bible can only have one meaning. Every verse can only be interpreted in one correct way." And she said, and this is the image I think is so beautiful. She said, "For Jews, the Bible is an endless well of meaning, or a well of endless meaning. I can't remember exactly how Brian put it, but either way, it works. This well of endless meaning." And so, learning to read the Bible from different perspectives just enriches our appreciation of the text. And so, so reading the Bible from a colonialist perspective, reading the Bible from an LGBTQ perspective, from a feminist perspective, it really, really opens up the text in such new and exciting ways. Learning, there's a New Testament with Jewish commentary. I just love it, the Jewish New Testament. There is, I would love to see a Muslim New Testament, or a Muslim Bible commentary. I don't know that there's a Buddhist Bible commentary, but there is a Buddhist commentary on the rule of Saint Benedict, and that's fascinating.
Interesting.
So, learning to see this text that we has been given to us as sacred, this text that has been given to us as sacred, and to recognize that there are so many different ways of reading it and understanding it. And I think, a lot of Christians are afraid of that because it takes us into that place of not knowing. It takes us squarely into the mystery. And yet, when you learn to find God's safety in the unknowing, then it becomes this incredible adventure and this journey into discovering the riches of the spiritual life from many, many different perspectives.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah, you know, so that, I think that's something else we can celebrate here.
Yeah, one of my most memorable classes or moments in seminary was with my hermeneutics professor. And he was, you'll know in a minute why, but he was dismissed from the seminary shortly after this experience I'm gonna share with you. But he broke the class up into, I don't know, let's just say like 10 different groups, and he gave us all the same passage of the Bible. And he said, this group over here, you guys are a bunch of Calvinists. And he said, you guys over there are atheists, and you guys over there are Buddhists, and you guys are any. He gave us this, he gave us like a sheet describing what our beliefs were. And he said, now what I want you to do is I want you to read this passage through the lens of these beliefs, and then I want you to write a sermon about that passage of the Bible, or come up with an outline for a sermon. And we had 10 different groups, with 10 different perspectives, with 10 different sermons, all in this Bible passage. And it freaked me out because, again, I'm in this setting where there's in our preaching class, we're learning about how to find the big idea of the passage, which is the one idea that this passage is presenting. And here's this other guy in my other class who's telling us that this Bible verse has 10 different meanings to it. And I didn't know what to think, and it blew my mind. But looking back on it, I realized like what a formative moment that was in my faith, because even though I didn't grasp it right away, it planted a seed deep down inside that has really begun to grow in this season of my life. And I had that professor on the podcast about a year or so ago, and I asked him about that moment in that class, and he remembered that. And I said that thing I was not able to grasp it at that moment, but thank you for being brave enough to present that material in that setting that we were in, because it really transformed my life later on. And now that's how I view the Bible now, is I view it as this amazing collection of stories that we can all read from different perspectives, and we can all learn deeper things about this beautiful diamond of God that has these many different angles and cuts to it.
And like any story, there is conflict. There's, you
Right.
know, there's good guys and bad guys. And you know, and so, you know, I don't, I think again, it may have been Richard Rohr, somebody, you know, in the contemplative world who talks about how the Bible is the story of a certain community within the human family, the Jewish community, and then the early Christian community, learning how to relate to God.
That's right.
And like any other learning experience, they make some big mistakes.
Yep.
They go down some blind alleys. They, you know, they have moments of insight, moments of incredible. I think it's Rohr who says three steps forward, two steps back,
Yep.
you know. And so if you read it from that kind of process perspective, then you see that you can let go of that, you know, there's one true meaning perspective. And you don't have to let go of the Bible or of the biblical tradition.
That's right.
That there is, it is still such a gift to help us nurture our faith.
Yeah.
Even if we find ourselves really wrestling with and really angry with and really, you know, kind of in this place of uncertainty, the place of mystery
Yeah.
with it.
Yeah.
And then trusting that the Spirit, who is true love, will meet us even in those shadowy places.
That's right. I find I have a deeper appreciation for the Bible today than I think I ever had for. And I've had people tell me, people reach out to me from my past and say, like, I can't believe you've abandoned the Bible and you obviously don't believe in the Bible anymore. I'm like, whoa, like, that's not true at all. Like, I read the Bible all the time. I feel like I love the Bible more than I ever have before. I just see it in an entirely different way. And it's okay if you don't see it that way. And I'm not, you don't have to see it that way. This is just the way that I see it now. And, I feel like it's opened up a whole new world for me. And so I'm learning in my life to not take the comments that other people put on me about my faith
Yeah.
and make them my own, but I'm really, trying to embrace my own walk and my own faith. So anyway, Carl, we're just about out of time, but this has been a ton of fun. Thank you for making time for me. Thank you for your book. Thank you for your work. I appreciate you.
Oh, it's been a delight. Thank you. Thank you
And
very
real quick,
much.
where can people go to interact with you online? Any kind of social media places, websites you want to direct us to?
Sure. My own website is anamkara.com. That's an Irish word that means soul friend. So that's ANAMCHARA.com, anamkara.com. Of course, I'm on, Facebook. I'm on Instagram. And if you want to support my work, I'm on Patreon also. So Patreon/Carl McColeman. So
Awesome. I'll put all the links in the show notes, and maybe we'll do this again when your next book comes out in 2025.
I would love to. Absolutely.
That'd be great.